Welcome, everyone. I'm Andrew Thompson, General Manager of CFMG Capital, and I'd like to welcome you to the 9th episode of Smart Capital. We're always looking for new ways to communicate with our growing community of investors and to keep them up to date with the latest happenings at CFMG Capital and the world of wealth generation. We started the Smart Capital podcast as a forum for all sorts of discussions and provide insight into how we approach investment management, project management and wealth generation, and some of the opportunities we see. Each month, we're inviting a different guest to have a chat about their area of expertise to help you on your journey to financial freedom. Our guest this week is Dan Holden. Dan is a founder and director of Holden Capital Partners, a development project financing group established in 2011 and specializing in construction finance, senior debt and mezzanine debt for property developers. With over 20 years' experience, he's previously worked in funds management and as a development manager. This episode, we want to provide some insight into some of the biggest misconceptions and misgivings investors have about private credit. Firstly, Dan, tell us a little bit more about your journey into project financing.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Andrew. So I guess my journey into project finance was I started out on the project side. So I was a development manager doing acquisitions and delivery of projects and actually seeing the projects come to life, which was exciting. And I did that for about 5 years. And one thing that I found in that journey was project finance either make or break of the project. So you'd have a great concept, the feasibility looks good, everything kind of ticks a lot of boxes. But if you don't have the funding to get the project out of the ground, it's just an idea. And so having funded quite a few projects in as the development manager and working with a few different groups and funders and brokers. One of the groups that we were working with was Ash Morgan Withrop, and they essentially said to me, why don't you come and work with us? And I thought that was quite interesting. One thing I found interesting about that was instead of a project, so I did a bunch of apartment projects and land projects, and you kind of live and breathe the same project for example, one that I did was 38 apartments. You live and breathe that for 2.5 years to see the whole thing from acquisition right through to delivery, sales and settlements. Whereas in the finance world, your project life cycle from looking at it to begin with, getting the project funding set, and then you're on to the next one. And so it was a lot more dynamic, which I found a lot more exciting. And you're across a bigger variety of projects. So I found that really interesting as well. So I started Ash Morgan 2007 and then the GFC hit. So that was quite interesting timing. So I was the 116th employee and the last one hired before the GFC in Ash Morgan. But funnily enough, in that time, it was hard to set deals, not many projects stacked up. But the one skill set that I had, which others didn't quite have as much of, is actually hands-on property experience. And so in the credit crunch, it was highest and best use of property. How do we maximize our exit of this project? So Ash Morgan had money invested in a variety of projects. And so then it was more the hands-on skill set that I had that actually kept me in the job. So I was actually the sixth last to leave in 2011.
Yeah, so not a last in, first out. They had a pretty niche skill set that they would have been leaning on quite a bit.
Yeah, and look, it was really interesting times. A lot of it was workout. A lot of it was how do we get the best bang for buck out of this investment that we've made. Very valuable experience. I was happy to continue the project finance journey, but ultimately I had to set up my own shop. So it wasn't the grandmaster plan always, but at that time, Ash Morgan was no longer doing that project finance role. And so I had to go out and set up my own business, which I did in December 2011. And so I started out as a finance broker for the first number of years and setting $300, $400, $500 million a year of project finance, variety of projects, mainly Queensland-based, but occasionally nationally. And back then, there wasn't that many non-bank lenders around. There was probably 12 to 15. Now there's over 300. So it was a totally different marketplace.
Yeah, we've talked on this podcast about the significant growth in this space.
It's been so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and speaking freely, like having also had a background like yourself, starting in that delivery project management side or developer side, having a financier or a funding partner that actually understands the development process is fairly unusual, but a pretty big positive.
Absolutely, yeah. And so that's when I was in the brokerage space, I guess that was, like you say, a value add, having been in that developer side, but also being able to pitch the developers' deals to the banks or the lenders who were active. That definitely helped. And so I started the business. We grew to 19 people. So it was BRW Fast 100, BRW Fast Starter. We were in the industry awards. We were number one firm in Queensland 3 years in a row and number one firm nationally 3 years in a row. So we did that big kind of growth and push. And back then, the barrier to entry to be a lender was really high. It's significantly lowered in recent years. And pretty much now anyone can call themselves a lender without really needing any credibility or kind of licensing or anything. It's really changed a lot. So growing from brokerage and being the number one broker in the country for many years, the natural logical next step was to become a lender ourselves. And so that was back then more challenging. So we essentially started quite small as about 9 years ago now. And so we started literally just doing a $2 million loan, two investors with $1 million each. We were the lender, the loan manager, and off we went. And we kind of grew from there. So it really grew kind of organically and not in a rush. We weren't trying to take over the world, but loans that we would previously be asked to broker to get the best market terms and get the loan settled, we were now saying, look, as an option, we could do the loan. And a lot of, I guess, developers, they want the solution, and yes, they want a good price, but they want it done. They want certainty, and they just want to get on with what they're good at, which is finding the next project, delivering the project. And so as that business grew and fast forward to where we are today, so we've now in 9 years invested over $600 million across, I'd say, at a guess, probably 200 projects in the 9 years. We do generally about 25 construction projects a year as a lender. And we've invested $600 million to date and we haven't lost a dollar. And so that's something that we're proud of. It's easy to lend money. It's harder to get it back. And so having done that for a long time as a broker, bringing that skill set into being a lender, having that discipline and the, I guess, the mindset that this is a long-term business for us. It's not a grab the cash as a broker and get out of the way and move on to the next deal. We need to choose deals and borrowers that we want to work with ongoing. So yeah, I guess that's the journey to date.
So when you made the transition, I guess, from broker to lender, your biggest challenge in establishing that business wouldn't have been deal origination. You would have had quite a strong following and demand for your services from the development world. It would have been your capital raising and finding the investors.
Definitely.
That was a new sales process for you, I guess.
Absolutely. And then it becomes, instead of just one client, if you will, you've then got another client type being the investor on the other side. And so to do that, initially I was doing it kind of ad hoc with the, you know, dozen or so people that I knew had money and knew me and trusted me. And so it was very, I guess it was more lax in the early days that I was, as I said, two blokes with $1 million each. I'm the lender, let's go.
Yeah.
And then it kind of grew from there. So probably for, I'd say, 12 to 18 months, I was doing it myself. And then someone who I knew who worked for a competitor, Gary Connolly, who I'd known for quite a few years before that, kind of socially, I said, mate, this is, going to grow into a bigger business and I'd love for you to be part of it. And so he's been there now for 9 years and working alongside. So I guess I'm the, if you will, the BDM dealing with the developer side and Gary's in kind of loan fund management and the investor side.
Yep, yep. I'm obviously familiar with Gary and see him out on the circuit as well myself. Yep. So didn't realize he'd been there that long actually. So he's a good operator, Gary.
Yeah.
Would have been a strong Irish accent on the podcast if we had him, but I definitely
need English subtitles for it.
Yeah. So I guess first question now that we've got into the meat and potatoes is what are the biggest misconceptions or misgivings investors have about private credit that you're seeing these days?
Yeah. So I guess if you're an investor who hasn't invested in private credit, probably the biggest fear or hesitation that they probably have is the fact that it's kind of a long dated process. So it's not like you can invest in a 30-day or 90-day kind of investment bond, or you could buy CBA shares at $150 and sell them at $155 and you're in and out. It is a longer term commitment. And so, you know, to get the money back that we lend in project finance, you've got to deliver the project. you've got to sell or refinance the asset and repay that loan. And so the investors essentially, you know, kind of wedded to that thing until it matures. So I think that's probably that's you know, some of the inquiries that we get from people who aren't actively investing in private credit is, how do I get my money back? And when they realize that it's not until project completion and loan repayment, that's probably a hesitation that I'd say people have in the initial phase.
The liquidity or lack of, in
correct,
some cases.
And the fact that it has to go well to repay their investment, and that they're basically the bank to that developer. So that's probably the initial kind of questions or hesitations that investors have. But once they're actually invested in it or have done a couple of loans, I mean, the best investor for us or investor inquiries, yes, they're investing in one of our, you know, competitors or colleagues in our industry. So they at least know the basics of investing in private credit. But I'd say that's also possibly a risk that they're an investor might not quite understand as well, to kind of go, this developer's borrowing short to then repay long, and that project completion and success is the exit. So if something goes wrong along the way, heaven forbid, touch wood, as I said, we've never lost a dollar, so we've definitely had some that have had speed bumps, but it's, you know, as a lender, rolling the sleeves up, jumping in, seeing what we can do to help, as opposed to just sending the borrower letters of demand and saying, you've got a problem.
Exactly. And that's where your background, I guess, in the development management side and hands-on project management expertise can bring some value to that process, because you're not just a lender lending out the money and sitting back, and then you find out something's gone wrong via a report and you've got no value or expertise to add other than sending them a demand letter. Having that project management background is a massive, massive positive, certainly for both your investors and for your
And it's also, I guess, having as opposed to, you know, a lawyer or a typical banker jumping into that role. I'll give an example. We had a project that the builder and the developer had a fight, funnily enough, a physical fight as well. And so we had to jump in, and even as basic as literally putting all of the warranties and manuals together so that the new buyer could come in. So it was a service station. So it had the tenant. Then we had to kind of handle the tenant and getting them in and getting all that done. And then ultimately we couldn't quite get the price that we needed to get the best bang for buck. So that was just before COVID. We finished the service station. And so the developer kind of went pretty much submarine and didn't want to, finish his commitment. So we actually finished that, went to put on the market, COVID hit, everything went pretty kind of tense. And so we actually held that asset. And so the tenant was paying rent, and we held it for until we could get the yield that we needed to. So thankfully in that, we had probably, I'd say, 8 or 9 investors. All of those are still with me today, because we were, I guess, suggesting and recommending to them that we think this is the right thing, and they supported our decision, and we ended up getting all our money back and no loss of capital and actually a good return. So,
and would have paid some distributions along the way when the rent came
in. When the rent came in, yeah. Correct. Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, I guess that is an example. If you were a litigious lender, you would just throw the book at the guy, but he'd already kind of disappeared anyway, not adding any value. So we were, hands on.
You're just getting pennies in the dollar because you're impatient.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess like your model, different to us in the sense that we're a retail. So we raise retail capital. You stick with sophisticated. And then obviously all of our stuff is related party, so we're lending on projects that we manage. But you're not like one of the really big operators where you're just lending willy-nilly to any developer that comes on. You've got a sort of a
correct,
very established book of clients that you lend to.
We do,
Repeat business.
A lot of repeat business.
You're not taking on sort of new developers you haven't done significant DD or business with in the past.
Correct. And I guess the benefit, I mean, Brisbane's a somewhat a small town, particularly in the property industry. It's usually a phone call or two before you've got, either a bit of dirt on them because they're not a good operator, or a recommendation where they say, yeah, I've known that guy for a while. He's a good bloke. He's a good operator. And looking at their past projects. But yes, we are a lot more hands-on, as a lender. Not hands-on. We're a lot more, we want to meet and greet the borrower if they're new to us. We want to kind of do a fact find, look at the track record of projects they've delivered, obviously look at their balance sheet strength, But the delivery side of it really is around, if there's an issue, can they solve it? Have they had issues on the previous projects? If they say no, they've all been, you know, then they're not being truthful, because every project has a hiccup. Yeah. It's just having the resources, the skill set, the smarts to get it solved, get it back on track and get it finished. You don't get repaid until it's finished. So it's, yeah, it's that we want to see in the borrower. And so even if it's a, you know, if a broker originated loan, we'll say, great, let's all jump on a Zoom call. We just want to eyeball them, get to know them, hear about their previous projects, hear about their journey to date, because, you know, you don't come out of high school and go straight being a property developer. So what was their kind of profession prior to that, that hopefully gives them a bit of a skill set into one aspect of property development. And so, yeah, one of the ones that we really like is, yep, I did 10 years at Mervac, Stockland, whatever. And this is, you know, I've done two or three projects on my own, you know, a single house build, a two house build, a four house build, and that natural progression. Yeah, seeing someone come straight out of the gates from another profession, I'm doing a 50 lot land sub, you go, mate, that's pretty...
It's a big jump.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just those kind of logical things that they sound logical when you think about it, but putting it into practice and actually being disciplined to go, look, we just don't think this is the right fit. And saying no is hard. Like it's the, particularly for someone you've known, I had to do it this week, actually. Lovely guy, you know, has been a real estate agent for a long time and essentially was jumping into his first project, which was quite significant. And I just had to be honest and say, mate, I'd love to do your third or fourth project with you, but, and I'd probably do your first one with you if it was a logical size project, but it's too big, too quick. And so therefore I don't want to be, you know, I don't need to, the experience of doing that one. So,
I suppose two-stage due diligence, you know, do you like the operator? That's tick one. Do you like the project? We've got to get a tick on both.
Yep.
And because of the nature of, I guess, the way you do your funds, it's all contributory. So every fund is a standalone investment. They know exactly what they're getting in for. You've assessed the project and the borrower.
Yep.
You're not running a pooled scheme where you feel pressure to add projects into your pool to keep the funds going out.
Correct.
And I guess that's the benefit of, you know, there's a bit of a segue. Like we run a pooled scheme as well, which we launched 3 years ago. But the benefit of that is a lot of that is lending into projects we've already got,
yep,
refinancing things. So we're not chasing projects to populate our pooled scheme either. Whereas that's where, you know, a challenge can arise if you're running this massive pooled scheme.
And that's an interesting thing that you touch on there, because it is a big risk in our industry generally. Some of our other lenders in the industry, I should say, are funded by warehouse facilities, which there is a big impetus for them to get that money out. Yeah,
and so all in their pocket.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when we're doing the brokerage stuff, a lender would get a fresh 100 mil tranche and they'd be like, whatever's on your desk, we'll give you an approval for it. Like that's, I'm not joking. Yeah. They were like, they just had to get the money out the door and it was already burning a hole in their pocket. They had to get it out straight away. So they were like, what, just tell me the hairs on it. We'll figure it out and we'll make it happen. So that to me is risky lending, because they just have to, their credit criteria and their discipline for credit drops dramatically, because they're essentially running at a loss with that big warehouse sitting there not invested.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the challenge for the investor is, you know, talking about misconceptions and misgivings is in your due diligence process as an investor, you're looking at all these potential issues that we're talking about that exist in our space, but then you tar the entire industry with the same brush. Whereas Holden Capital Partners, ourselves, these things don't necessarily apply to us, but you need to be safe or be sure in your due diligence process why these risks aren't as present.
Yep.
In investments with our two firms, for example. How would you suggest an investor assesses a private credit manager, you know, or manages risks?
Yeah, so based on the questions that we get asked by investors who get referred to us or inquire to invest with us, I'd say it's, definitely track record. You know, if there is a history of losses, I guess asking what happened and what could you have done better? Probably one of the first questions we get asked is, have you lost money? That's a really big one. There are quite a few lenders who have had issues in the past and look, it is, I guess, a space when you're dealing, when you're investing and then the developer is the one ultimately in control of the project, you are for some, in some aspects, kind of in the back seat and you're not really able to be in charge of the destiny of the project. So from that point of view, if you're interviewing a lender or private credit manager for that You'd want to be saying, at what point did you have a project that didn't go well, and what did you do to jump in, or not jump in, but what did you do proactively to see that this actually was a success and not a failure? So that's probably what I'd be asking as an investor. The other things, yeah, is just structure, first mortgage, second mortgage, equity, and then just checking that the return that they're not promising, but saying that they're going to give you is justified for that security and that risk. So yeah, if they're lending at 75% LVR and no pre-sales, and if you've got a heartbeat as a borrower, they'll lend you money, that kind of a lender, probably pretty risky. I guess if it's someone more on the hands-on, does a lot of DD like us that and hasn't lost any money, you'd be saying that's a great track record. Not to say it'll continue forever, because it is a high risk space that, you know, kind of the double digit returns that you're getting, that those returns are for a reason. But ultimately I'd be saying, yeah, tell me your life story and tell me why you're doing it as well. The other one, I guess, is that the investors would want to see is the alignment of interest. So, what is the return that the fund manager is getting? Some of our competitors charge, or give the investors, say, 7%, lend it out at 10%, and they charge a 2% origination fee. So they're earning 5%, and that's not even their money. So understanding the actual...
Good space to be in if you can get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's plenty of lenders that do it. Yeah. They get a big net interest margin, and they get all their loan establishment fees. They're making 5%, the investor's making 7%, and it's the investor's money at risk. Mm. So that, to me, feels out of balance, right? So it's just understanding how their fund works, how their... structure works, what their credit process is, and ultimately it's track record, because track record speaks volumes. So yeah, I'd be asking those kind of questions. I'd also ask for recommendations or referrals of their current investors.
Metrics. Yep. Yeah.
As an example, we host an annual investor lunch. We actually love it because some of our investors that have been with us since day one, they're our biggest advocates, you know.
Absolutely. We have investors. We have events like that. And your best salespeople are your current investors.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Harping on the point again, the question that we get asked commonly as well is, have you ever lost any money? The answer is no. The natural question that follows that, well, what would you do if you do, or you face a problem? And you can answer that question with, you've got established project management background, you've delivered projects, you've got the ability to assess something rather than just be a litigious lender that sends a default notice.
Right.
You can provide some expertise to manage a problem through a project.
Yep.
And I guess, where we differ in some ways, but we're similar in others. Obviously, we're running the projects ourselves, so you can't get a better alignment of interest. But obviously, you guys, when you're lending out, you've got this suite of clients that, I know from talking to Gary over time, while, you're not lending it all to one particular borrower, you don't have hundreds of borrowers. You've got a suite of repeat customers over and over again.
Yep.
And that rings true both on the borrower side and the investor side.
Absolutely. And so we've got last year, over 70% of our loans were to people we'd already lent to before. And that the good thing about that is it's familiarity. So we've seen them deliver. We've seen them, as I said, most projects are going to have a problem at some point. And we've seen those borrowers, when the problem arises, that they've jumped in and fixed the problem quickly, or that they've hopefully got a balance sheet. I mean, money solves lots of problems, right? Mm. And so if there is a problem that they've gone, great, not great, but okay, I know there's a $400,000 problem, but I've got $400,000 to fix that problem and let's keep going. And so that's the kind of, I guess, familiarity you get with dealing with those borrowers. So we've, as a lender ourselves, we've had, I think, 25 projects that we've done with a property developer at the Sunshine Coast. And I think we've done over 40 projects with a developer down the Gold Coast. And so our investors hate the next one of those projects.
Yeah, next one those guys come across.
So
yeah.
those two particular developers, we've got another developer I think we've done 18 projects with. We put that up on our investor portal and it's filled with minutes because it's familiarity, right? So that's definitely a key for us.
Oh, I mean, like it's amazing with anything. Track record has got to be a critical factor in anything you do. Like anyone in the industry or not in the industry knows that whenever time you advertise things like that, you always have to say past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. And that's, you know, that's a compliance obligation. But yeah. I always say, you know, it's not a reliable indicator, but it's a bloody good guide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I guess moving on to the next question, what you guys do particularly to manage investment risk or manage, you know, risk management and how you communicate with your clients when, if and when problems do arise.
Yeah. So every Tuesday we have our WIP meeting, which is our full credit team and all of our staff. And so we go through each loan every week, which is a process, but it's a valuable process. And so we want to check each loan, check its expiry, simple things, checking their insurances up to date. When did we last report to investors? Sometimes there's not much happening with the project, so we don't report for the sake of reporting. But every drawdown we do on a project during construction, we send an update to the investors. I'd say probably every third or fourth time, it's actually Gary or myself on site. And investors love those videos because we do a little video there. We show the project status. We talk through the project status. Sometimes we get the developer to jump on and kind of tell us something about the project. And so our investors really see that project come to life and they feel like they're a part of it. It goes from, you know, I guess in the land subspace, a cow paddock to being fully titled bitumen roads and people ready to start their construction. So they see that and we find we get a lot of great feedback out of those updates.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen those videos and it just shows you're not a passive lender that's sitting in your office deploying capital. I've seen, you know, Dan's head walking around on site with the banners behind him.
Yep.
Clearly on site, understanding and interviewing the developer. So
yep. Yeah. And I guess in terms of how we're managing that risk, when loans are coming to completion or loans are slow, so we've got one at the moment. It's a two-house build in a great suburb in Brisbane, and we're kind of up to month five and the slab hasn't gone down. We're like, hey, mate, can we meet you on site? Because we just want to get a bearing of where things are up to. And so on that one, we're actually just settling a five-month extension now. So rather than wait until month 12 and the roof's only just gone on, we're ahead of the risk and we're jumping on it now and saying, hey, if we can mutually agree to extend this loan by an extra 5 months to give you sufficient time to finish, then we're happy to continue doing the project. If not, maybe you're better off finding another lender who looks the other way and we'll just send you a litigious letter at month 12 and says you're in trouble. So that's probably a way that we're managing our risk, where we're constantly monitoring the project, comparing it to our loan expiry, or basically just when they expected to finish the project, because we signed up to that loan on the basis that they were going to finish at a certain time. And if it's not going to be met, that's fine. Those things happen. But let's agree a new date and let's now target that date. Mm. And that's what it's about, is just managing that. At the moment, we've got no loans expired. We've got no loans in default. But that's through active management.
And even through that example, just understanding why. I mean, I can relate very clearly to that one. I'm doing a two-house build myself. Luckily, don't have a lender. And I was supposed to start 2 years ago and I still haven't started. So
there you go.
Those things happen, good old councils and street trees and all the other factors that can come into it. So
exactly.
One of the questions in there was what happens when loans go bad, but I think we've sort of covered that with a pretty colourful story about the service station.
Yeah, look, I think if loans go bad, because it does happen, it's just getting active, sitting down with the developer and asking what they plan to do. Because sometimes, you know, a natural human reaction is to kind of put your head in the sand and go, what problem? I don't see a problem. Mm. And so it's really just having that hard conversation and ultimately saying, hey, look, we are here to help you. We're not going to solve the problem for you, but we want to talk through a couple of options that you might have and how we fix it. And so that's, I guess, not so much to say it's a hands-on approach, but it's a logical way to sit down and talk to them about it, as opposed to just send letters and hide behind a lawyer. But also you probably find that person, you know, they're probably not stage fright, but they're probably a deer in headlights too, going, well, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, they're probably thinking they are going to get some kind of legal letter as opposed to someone who wants to work with them. So, yeah.
But the biggest thing I try and emphasize to them is indecision is a decision. So you're just choosing not to do anything and just hope it'll all fix itself. You're also deciding that, you're kind of ignoring the problem altogether. And look, I've seen builders and developers fight. I've seen the builder-developer fighting with the QS about costs. I've seen all kinds of stuff. I mean, the thing I love about my job is you're kind of sitting there with the popcorn watching these projects come to life. And sometimes when they don't go well, you're watching how they manage that problem and solve it. So working across, as I say, 25 kind of projects a year that we do, you really get to see some fun stuff. And I guess one thing that our investors say is they love seeing it all come to life too. So yeah, it is really good, enjoyable spot to be.
Yeah, good study in human behavior. Mm. But the I guess the alignment of interests is that's where it becomes critical as well. And having a perfect track record, because then you become almost obsessive about protecting that track record, where some of the bigger operators in the space, you know, as you said, they're collecting a 2% deal origination fee. They're charging a 3% loan margin.
Yep.
Something goes bad, they're just like, oh, I've got 80 other loans. I've already collected my 2% origination.
Correct.
I'll just send them a letter and move on to the next one.
Yep. And they'll just blame the borrower, as opposed to taking some ownership themselves and saying, yeah, we could have done a better job, or, you know, here's what we tried to do.
But if that lender had a 100% track record of performance, they when you've got that record, you become obsessive about protecting it.
Definitely.
Once one goes bad, they might think, oh, well, now one's gone bad. Doesn't matter if the second one goes bad. And, you know, you don't want to get into that space.
Yep. Yeah. And I think also it's a, you know, the drive to, I guess, be bigger and growth and all that kind of stuff. It's the discipline to not have to do a deal. And when you've got like a warehouse line of credit or whatever type of funding you've got, that's what's, I guess, pushing that lender to do the deal anyway. Our money, our investors, when they're invested in a project, at the end of the project, we give the money back. And then we offer or invite them to participate in the next loan. So there's no obligation for them to continue. They can take the money off the table. We automatically send it back to them. So it's not, some lenders actually keep it in a little side pool in the trust account ready for the next deal. We literally send it back to the investor. And then we present a next opportunity and we say, we like this deal. If you like it too, you can participate. So it's definitely opt-in for them. But where I was getting with that is that at the end of the loan, we give the money back. There's no obligation for us to do another deal. We do it because we want to do another deal and we like this particular next transaction. It's not because we've got money costing us money that we have to get it back out the door. And so we can particularly, you know, December, January, February, we're, you know, generally quiet for seasonal reasons. It's just always been that way. And if we had a warehouse there, we'd have to get 10 million every month out the door. We don't have that pressure. So it's a much better place to be in, without that kind of anxiety to get a deal done. It's a better place, and therefore you're choosing better deals because you're doing a deal because you like it, genuinely like it.
Oh, and that return, it's really critical. Like we find, certainly when we only did contributory schemes, but investors could roll from one to the other, they do have the choice with us. They can either receive the full funds and their dividends back, then reinvest, or they can roll over and a portion. But a lot of our investors, and I always encourage them to, you know, take the money back in your account, see it in your account, touch and feel it, it's yours,
yep,
then reinvest it. Because it's just something far more real about receiving it and then your choice to reinvest it. Whereas, you know, like we don't want to go too far off tap, but like people like Bernie Madoff and that sort of players, yeah, if all those people asked for that, well, they wouldn't have got where they were.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Seeing that money in your account and you physically choosing what to do with it,
yep,
is a critical important.
Because then they're with the control. They choose to reinvest. They choose to continue. That's a sense of relief for them.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'd be, you know, one of the points to make is I'd be very wary of any organization that's typically always encouraging you to roll over and not wanting to actually return the funds to you at some point.
Yep.
So I guess the final question in our questionnaire is, where do you think investors should start in terms of talking about their portfolio allocation, growth strategies, income strategies, things like that?
So I guess in terms of starting, we always say to a new investor, just start with 100 grand. That's our minimum investment, and watch it and watch us perform and then kind of grow from there. We do get some people, particularly the bigger kind of family office investors, that are like, oh, we want to just give you 5 mil on day one. We're like, no, just watch us.
I just want to dip my toe in the water and you think you're going to get 200 and say, no, they want to give you 2 million.
And there's a lot of, there is a lot of investors out there that are kind of forcing money onto us, but we want each loan to have preferably, 5 to 15 investors is a good size. We want to try and get one or two new investors into each loan so that they experience and we're kind of growing our investor book that way. But I guess for a new investor investing in private credit, I'd say, do your homework. Those previous points I raised in terms of what you should be asking that private credit provider. And I'd say, just start slowly. You don't have to invest everything all on black. You can kind of just, if you're currently heavy in shares or heavy in property and you want to look at private credit, I'd say just start slow, research lots, ask around, ask other people what their portfolio weighting might be. I know some of our investors are, 50% property, 50% shares in private credit, a good financial advisor or just doing your own research to figure that out, just how you balance that. And so if private credit's a new thing, I'd say just agree that you're going to go 5% of your total portfolio and give it a run and see how it goes. And it might grow to 15 or 20 after that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, using the analogy, dipping the toe in the water, some toes are bigger than others, that's for sure. And I guess with, your example before, you've got two developers in particular that you've done 20 plus deals with on the Sunshine Coast and Gold Coast. The moment you put them in the investor portal, they fill up quickly.
Yep.
You might have a big dog, for lack of a better term, that wants to take the whole thing out, but I imagine you cap it to try and...
We do, and that's why we try and get 5 to 15 per loan no matter what. We've got some that go, I'll do the whole 5 mil.
It just
doesn't work for our business to do that.
Yep.
Because we want everyone to kind of be party to that loan. So yeah, we try and share love.
Good. Well, I think we've wrapped it up there. So some really good insights from Dan. Good to hear, I guess, the background of how Holden Capital came to be. We used to be neighbours. We've moved into the city now, but Holden Capital Partners, and not only that, I've been neighbours of Gary at many a financial expo or a financial event, and we follow each other on stage. So it's good to get Dan on and hear all about Holden Capital Partners. So
thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks, mate.